I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. There's a great new book out if you're interested in going into journalism, or if you're like me, just interested in journalism. It's called Life in the Wrong Lane, Why Journalists Go In When Everyone Else Wants Out. It's by Greg Dobbs, who for 23 years was with ABC News as a producer and later as a correspondent. He reported overseas from Europe during the Cold War to Iran, Afghanistan, and Libya, among others. In the United States, he was there when Gary Gilmore was executed, and he was at Wounded Knee. What fascinated me the most was that he began his career with the recently departed the fine broadcaster Paul Harvey. Greg Dobbs is a winner of two Emmy Awards and is a correspondent for HDNet's World Report. The book, Life in the Wrong Lane, is published by iUniverse. Please welcome to the Plant Online program Greg Dobbs. Good morning, Mr. Dobbs.
Good morning to you, and it's nice to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Paul Harvey, I grew up listening to the rest of the story, and in recent years I would hear his reports online, I guess WABC Radio in New York. What was he like to work for?
He was remarkably flexible, and I say that because it was my first real job with the ABC News Network, and it was with ABC Radio, of course. And I was a greenhorn. I was almost fresh out of journalism school. He already was the biggest voice on the radio in North America. And yet, once he learned to trust me, he opened himself to my critiques. He opened himself to my suggestions. And he allowed himself, to change the way he approached commentary, and as a result of something a 23-year-old kid told him. He was a good guy. You called him a fine broadcaster. I would even use a different adjective. He was an incomparable broadcaster. Number one, because of the way he wrote.
Yeah.
I always joked, Joe. I said I always wrote his pauses. But he was also incomparable because of the way he delivered the news. People absorbed it. And, of course, that's incredibly interesting. When you look at a newspaper paragraph and you don't absorb it because it's not well written the first time, you can go back and read it a second time. But that isn't true in your business or mine. Paul Harvey only had to say it once and everybody got it.
And his voice was so unique. I'm a big fan of Imus. And Imus says that the three great voices in radio, Paul Harvey's Wolfman Jack and Jack Benny.
Yeah, that's true it is. Well, Rochester as well.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. How old, how long, you said you were 23 when you worked for him. How long did you work for Paul Harvey?
A couple of years. I think it was 2.5 years. I actually am flattered when you say you used to like to listen to the rest of the story episodes, because he gave me the opportunity to write some of those in the early stage of that particular feature.
And the research involved with that was pretty tough. You had to source everything, right?
Yes. He was a good journalist. Mind you, in those days, of course, we didn't have the Internet. This was in the, the late 60s, the end of the 60s, into the 70s. We had wire machines with reams of paper, and we must have had 8, 9, 10 machines in our little newsroom, and his office was almost adjacent to mine. And so he had to go through miles of wire copy every day, and that was the role of the editor. Nobody had to teach him how to write, but the role of the editor was to make sure that him having gone through so much, that he got it all right. Every day there'd be a few little mistakes, and my job was to have read the stuff thoroughly enough to catch those before he went on the air.
Now, HDNet is available in Canada through Bell and Shaw.
Yes, it is.
We don't have HD at our house, so I don't get to see it. Your colleague, Dan Rather, he was here a year ago in Vancouver doing a piece for his program. How do you find working at HDNet? I guess Mark Cuban owns that, does he?
Mark Cuban founded it, the owner, best known as the owner of the Dallas Mavericks. Of course, he was also a contestant on Dancing with the Stars.
That's right, yeah.
Which I sometimes use as a contrast to the program that I'm involved in. You're right, Dan Rather, formerly of CBS News, is the head of a program called Dan Rather Reports. Oddly enough, it's named Dan Rather Reports on Tuesday nights. And then our program, and I'm the chief correspondent for it, is called World Report, and we follow Dan Rather Reports on Tuesday nights. And it's a very serious, substantive, long-form documentary-style program. And I kind of joke about our audience saying that they must be serious about information, about, a long, serious piece, because they could instead be watching Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah. Did you get to travel a lot for the program?
Get to or have to, depending on your point of view, but yes. You know, my book, Life in the Wrong Lane, which is where I've lived my life, is about the fact that you often travel to places when everybody who's smart, everyone normal, is trying to get out. We're in the wrong lane going in. I mean, this year alone, I've shot and reported programs in Vietnam about the legacy of Agent Orange, which the United States used during the Vietnam War, in Lebanon about terrorism, and we went and found a man who's considered the most heinous terrorist in the history of the relationship between Hezbollah and Israel, in Russia doing a program about their space program, in Indonesia about the filthy water and efforts by the World Bank to clean it up, the filthy water, which is all about half the people in Indonesia can depend on. We travel a lot. We also do things all over North America.
Now, 20 years ago, the Berlin Wall came down. Where were you? You were with ABC, I guess, were you?
Yeah, I'm laughing because I wasn't there and desperately wanted to be because I had spent cumulatively many years behind the Iron Curtain before the curtain crumbled. I was in Colombia trying to get into Panama because the Berlin Wall's destruction coincided with the American invasion of Panama back in the days of General Noriega.
Now, your profession, journalism, isn't as highly held a profession as it once was. Well, what do you think happened?
Well, that's a good question, and far be it for me to give you the definitive history of decline of journalism, at least as seen by so many consumers. But you have the 24-hour cable news offerings, which have forced many others in the news business to believe they can't really sit very long on a story, because if they do, by the time they come out with a much more detailed and perhaps much more accurate version, nobody's going to care anymore because they're already going to have had their stomach's worth on 24/7 cable news. Number two, you have the dispersal of sources, or I should say the expansion of sources, really, which disperses the audience. But, you know, you still got a lot more on television than you ever had in the old days. You've got radio. You've actually got more print than you used to have that's dealing with information. Then finally, but certainly not least, the Internet. And, you know, I don't call that a bad thing, Joe, but what I do say is that too many people fail to filter out the well-informed from the speculative, the opinionated from the reports that at least try to be objective. And as a result, it's all in one great big pot. And then that coincides with the economy. Just a couple of years ago, when I was in Europe on a shoot, and I got together with the former senior international correspondent for CBS News. I was with ABC, and we were competitors, but also friends. His name is Tom Fenton. And we were bemoaning the decline of the American network's coverage of the world, and we took a casual count of our respective networks and how many bureaus they had in their heyday, and it was around a dozen and a half. These days, in each case, it's three. Count them, three.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever think that it was a noble profession?
I still do.
You still do?
It was practiced perhaps a little more nobly in the old days.
Yeah.
And the old days, when I say the old days, I mean, we're going back not all that long, but I mean, here I worked for an American television network news operation, one of the most influential, certainly broadcasting institutions in the world, and yet its heyday lasted for roughly half my career, from the beginning of the 1970s until the early 1990s, and then things began to go into a slide. Very short heyday for such a once but briefly powerful institution.
Well, when Colonel Gaddafi gave that rambling speech at the UN some weeks ago, I remember looking at my Facebook feed, and people in the journalism business were all talking about it. But I'd seen something like 10 different spellings on how you spelled that name. You interviewed him?
I've interviewed him probably half a dozen times, and sometimes you think you're interviewing a friend of America, and other times you think you're not sure if you're interviewing Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Hyde, if I can put it that way. But yes, I've interviewed him under a tent. I've interviewed him in a field as he sat astride a Massey Ferguson. Isn't that a Canadian company?
It is, yeah.
A Massey Ferguson tractor, tilling the fields for his people, as he put it to me, until I asked him to turn off the tractor because it was ruining the audio for our television camera. And when I asked him to turn off the tractor, and this is a story I tell in Life in the Wrong Lane,
right,
he fished around for the key. pushed around for the key, and to save his life, he couldn't figure out how to turn off the tractor, just after having told me that he does this all the time, tilling the fields for the people. And one of his bodyguards saw how embarrassed he was and reached over and turned it off for him and said something to him in Arabic. And Gaddafi said to me, "Oh, I always forget. I'm just not very technical."
I wasn't born yet when the whole Gary Gilmore thing happened. You were on that story. You were one of the first people on that story, correct?
Yes, and it was a fascinating story for two reasons. One is that in the United States, there had been a moratorium for better than half a decade imposed by the United States Supreme Court to try to create more equity between the races as went sentences of capital punishment. In other words, disproportionate number of blacks were believed to be sentenced to capital punishment over and above whites. So there was a moratorium nationwide, and finally the Supreme Court said, we think all the states have come up with fairer rules. And so as it turns out, he was the first man to be executed under the new form of capital punishment, if you will, and he was in the state of Utah. That was the first thing that was interesting. The second was that he wanted to die. He was a double killer. He had killed a motel clerk and a gas station clerk, and he was 36 years old, as I recall. He had spent roughly half his life already behind bars because he had been a juvenile delinquent. So, not to my surprise, frankly, because I don't think I'd want to spend half my life behind bars, he said to the groups that were struggling to save his sorry soul, he said, "Get off my back, I want to die, I don't want to appeal the sentence." And so that was interesting, because you had the American Civil Liberties Union and the NAACP that were fighting to save a man who didn't want to be saved. And then the third interesting thing was, as a matter of fact, he had a girlfriend who was able to visit him in prison, but not once but twice smuggled sleeping pills to him, and twice he attempted to overdose and kill himself, and thus twice the state rushed him to the hospital so they could save his life, so they could kill him not long after.
Now, do you tell the story in the book, I think it's interesting, you ran into the girlfriend outside the prison, did you?
Well, I went looking for her. I was with a camera crew wondering I wanted to know what's it like being the girlfriend of a man who's convicted of twice, you know, killing innocent young clerks in their, while they were working. And so I'd been told by the warden that she visited him every day. And we just stationed ourselves in the parking lot, which was right next to an interstate highway. And I knew what she looked like from people's descriptions. I'd done a little homework. Out she came. And I went up to her, and she wanted nothing to do with me. And I did my best to ingratiate myself, but it wasn't very good. And she suddenly went walking up the ramp to go onto the highway, and I realized she had to hitchhike. And so I chased after her, and I said, "Look, I'll make you a deal. I will drive you. You'll decide on your own if you're going to let me interview you. If not today, then sometime down the road. But I'll drive you. You shouldn't be hitchhiking." So she took me up on it. It wasn't a very nice day. And I dropped her at her place, and she said, "Tell you what, meet me tomorrow outside the prison. I'll give you that interview." So the crew and I were there. But instead of her coming out, an ambulance went rushing in, and I ran into the warden, and I asked him what's going on. He said, "It's Gary Gilmore. He's overdosed again." It was the second time. And suddenly I thought of her. Nicole Barrett was her name, and we rushed to the hospital in Provo. Not much we could do about Gilmore, but I wanted to know had it been a double suicide attempt, and sure enough it was. Funny little story, if you have a minute.
Yeah, go ahead.
Funny under the circumstance. I decided, well, maybe if she's overdosed and survives to tell the story, I should ingratiate myself. This is what journalists do. It's not always so pleasant. We are obnoxious. But I should ingratiate myself with her family, assuming they'd been called to the hospital. And I got to the second floor of this hospital where I had seen on a chart ICU was located. And I could hear women bawling their eyes out. And I went around a corner, and there, sure enough, was the waiting room for ICU. And there were these women who were crying, crying streams of tears. And I just said, "I'll just go in, sit down quietly, won't say a word, I'll just become a part of the fabric of the room." But before I could get my butt in a seat, one of the women said, "Who are you? Are you a reporter?" And I'm not going to lie, I've never lied about what I do. And I said, "Well, yes, but..." She said, "Reporters aren't allowed here, don't you know that?" Well, I did know that, which is why I had removed my suit and tie, but nevertheless, she caught me in the act and shouted for security, and the gig was up, and I was out of there. 3 or 4 days later, I'm heading home to Chicago, where I lived at the time. I get on the plane, and I have a window seat, and I'm in coach, and I have to squeeze past the aisle seat and the center seat, both of which are occupied by women, and I look down, frankly, at the legs of the woman in the center seat as I'm squeezing by, and she's got a little typewriter. between her legs, in these days predating laptops. And I look at her face. It's the woman who had screamed at me in the waiting room, crying her eyes out along with everybody else. She was a reporter for Newsweek, who had gotten there before me, and had promised these women, look, you don't want to talk to reporters, but I will protect you from all the others if you will give your story to me. And sure enough, she had the cover story the next week in Newsweek. She had done a very good job.
Did you ever, I mean, throughout your career, you've been in dangerous places and the sort. Did you ever, was there a place where you really felt that your life was in danger, that you were going to buy it?
There were a few. I mean, I've covered, I counted recently, 8 wars. And you don't go in there unless you know there's a chance you won't come out vertically. But maybe, I can think of 2. One was during the revolution in Iran, and I'm not talking 2009. We'll call it Iran 1, take 1, which was 1979. And to make a long story short, the revolution had been brewing for a long time, but ultimately the fighting on the streets broke out in earnest one Friday night when young army recruits in uniform were caught listening to tapes of the Ayatollah Khomeini, the first Islamic ruler of Iran, and they were caught by senior officers, also in uniform. They started fighting, and the gunfire spilled out of the barracks into the base and ultimately into the streets and eventually across the country within a matter of days. But orders went out amongst the rebels, smash all cameras. They knew if they lost that videotape and still photos would be confiscated, that they would be seen for what they were, traitors, and they would be convicted and sentenced to die and executed probably on the spot. So smash all cameras. Well, we were spotted, camera crew and I were spotted covering the fighting and chased, thankfully not by a gang with guns, because they don't have to catch us. They just have to get close enough for the bullets to reach us, but rather a gang with machetes. And we were too loyal to ABC News to drop our equipment, which we should have done, but it was about $100,000 worth. So we were running toward the car and driver, who we knew were sitting about 4 blocks away. And by the time we got, he saw us coming, sped toward us, it was right out of a James Bond movie, did a quick skid U-turn, opened all the doors, we jumped in, and some of these guys got as far as the trunk of the car, before they got thrown off as he sped away. Had he been another block away, we'd have been dead meat. So, I saw my end being very, very near in that case. The other was a different kind of story in Beirut. I was looking for an American former CIA agent who was helping bad guys put their hands on bombs and other kinds of weapons. And I made contact with one of his associates, also an American, and he agreed to meet at a coffee shop in East Beirut in the hills. And we met there, and I'm trying to tell you this as quickly as possible. People can read about it in Life in the Wrong Lane, every colorful detail, but we're sitting side by side, just beginning to establish a little trust with one another to see if he is who I think he is and I am who he thinks I am from ABC. And 2 thugs walk in with machine guns over their shoulders, and they come in without a word and yank. He freezes when he sees them, and they yank him over the table, knocking over the table and all the coffee and the coffee cups and everything else, and he's screaming, no, 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 as they are dragging him, kicking and screaming, out of the coffee shop and into the parking lot and around a corner, never to be heard from again. I'm left sitting there thinking, oh, what if they get back and tell their boss he was with somebody, and the boss says, you nincompoops, go get the guy.
Yeah.
Plus, he left his briefcase, and I'm desperately interested in the contents of the briefcase because I'm there to learn what I can about this American turncoat. I sat for about 20 minutes. Everybody else just averts their eyes and goes on as if nothing's happened, because that's what people did in Beirut in those days. They saw this kind of thing all the time. I did, too. In this case, I was right in the heart of it. Ultimately, after 20 minutes, I got up and walked out as casual-looking as I could be, although my legs were probably shaking a little more like there was an earthquake underfoot, with the briefcase and got out of there.
What is the correspondence life? What does that do to your family life? I mean, they don't get to travel with you. You've got a wife and kids, right?
Yes. Yes.
How do they react to your line of work?
That's a great question, and I cannot answer it with humility, but to say that I have a very wonderful wife. Wonderful wife, because sometimes I left behind as a single mother, and there are, of course, a lot of single parents out there, and it's always tougher for them than it is for 2. But you add to that the fact that, number one, her spouse would leave on moment's notice. Number 2, she never knew when I'd be back. Number 3, sometimes I'd be gone in places where Some people never did come back. And number four, in the old days, and I'm still doing this kind of thing, but now we have all the modern communication everybody enjoys, email and cell phones, but in those days we didn't. And there was a nice side to that, too. We were out of touch. We could just do our jobs. But the downside was, I mean, I'll tell you a quick story if you have another minute.
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
All right, and this doesn't pertain directly to your question, but it's about my wife and me. We're trying to get into Uganda when the monster Idi Amin was being ultimately ousted by an army from Tanzania, his neighbor next door, that was embarrassed by his performance in Uganda. The Last Scottish King is the movie that was out a year or two ago about Idi Amin. And we're trying to get into Uganda. At a certain point, we're on the Kenyan side of Lake Victoria, the largest lake in Africa, thinking we might buy a boat from some fishermen and go across. We ultimately put the kibosh on that, but we just decided it wasn't real smart. We might end up in the wrong people's hands. But we have to spend the night there, and I decide to place a call on the one phone in the general store in this little village to ABC in New York to tell them where we were and what we had planned for the next day, how we thought we might actually get into Uganda. And so I placed the call, and it's traveling who knows how many thousands of miles to New York, and I can barely hear when I'm telling New York about it. Then I asked the switchboard operator at ABC in New York to give me my wife in London where we lived. And I can barely hear her when she answers. It's the middle of the night for me, the middle of the night for her. And she says hello, but I can barely hear her voice. And I said, hi, it's me. And she says, hi. And before anything else, she says, how would you like to see my father? Now, her father was a contractor in Kansas City, Missouri. And I shouted, what? And she starts to say again, how would you like to... Whack. The line goes dead. We lose the call. I can't call her back. It had taken about 6 hours to get the call through. The next morning, we're on our way. We did get into the war. We were there for a couple of weeks. When we got out, I called her before I called ABC because I had to know what she was talking about. I knew her father wasn't going to be anywhere in Africa. And I said, what did you mean when you asked me, how would I like to see your father? And she laughed. She said, no, no, no. I asked you, how would you like to be a father? She had learned that she was pregnant with our oldest son, who is 30 in 3 days from now. But she had just learned that that's what it's like to be the wife of somebody like me.
Yeah. There's some marvelous stories in this book, and you've told some of them. There are more. Yeah, go ahead.
The book is not just about all the daring things and dangerous things. Those are in there. But it's also about the funny things and the funky things and the downright stupid things that people like me do to get to the point of reporting a story. I don't tell you again about the Iranian Revolution or the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan or the Gary Gilmore execution. I tell you about all the crazy things that happen to reporters. So news junkies who might wonder what happens before the camera goes on or after the camera goes off, it's for them. And then it's for anyone in the English-speaking world who may hold journalists in some, you know, with some scorn, and maybe some of that is well-deserved, but they should know that journalists sometimes put a lot on the line, sometimes their very lives, to get the story and to report it back to people in places like Canada and the United States and Great Britain. And it's worth noting that it's not all about adventure or misadventure. Sometimes it's about sacrifice and intense discomfort and occasional danger to convey to people in free countries what's going on elsewhere.
So what would you carry with you if you were doing a live shot, say? So it's just you and I guess the cameraman, right?
Yeah.
Well, in terms of makeup and the sort of grooming, do you that yourself, I guess?
I don't do any.
You don't do any?
I consider it a, and it's stupid of me probably, but I consider it a concession to Hollywood. And so many people, all my life, Joe, people have said to me, so who writes your stuff?
Yeah.
You know, they say, well, you know, I've got a face that's okay for TV, and I've got a voice that works on TV and radio. So they assume somebody else is really the brains behind it, and I'm embarrassed by the impression they get. And so, I mean, I write my stuff. I do all my own reporting. I figure out my own questions. I don't have any you know, brains behind the scenes. And so one of the concessions I won't make is makeup for that stupid reason. But it's something personal. I've always felt that way.
Greg, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you and read this book.
Thank you.
It's a great memoir. Congratulations and continued good luck with it.
I appreciate it. I'm glad you read it, and I'm glad you're giving it exposure. Obviously, I'm in the business of selling books, but I'm also in the business of conveying the message that journalists do work hard and do try to get it right, and we're lucky as people in free countries to have the product of their work.
Indeed. The book is called Life in the Wrong Lane, Why Journalists Go In When Everyone Else Wants Out. It's published by iUniverse. If you do have HDNet in Canada here on your cable deal or your satellite deal, do check it out. World Report Tuesday nights. Greg Dobbs on the line in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.